Last lecture, we spent a lot of time talking about permanent molecular dipoles. And in fact, let's just go back to the lecture briefly so we can review where we left off. So the previous lecture, we had started talking about Vesper theory. So to be able to talk about the relationship between shape and polarity. On Wednesday, I backtracked a little bit and talked about bond polarity, because there's a difference between a bond being polar and a molecule being polar. So we talked about different examples where we have equal types of bonds, unequal types of bonds, shapes with lone pairs, shapes without lone pairs, but we got to the point of the story, which was this. When you have a permanent molecular dipole, like in a molecule of water, then that has a drastic effect on its physical properties. That's why a molecule like water exists at room temperature. The comparison I made was to methane, which doesn't have a permanent molecular dipole because it has a symmetric shape and all of the bonds in it are equivalent. So all of the bond dipoles cancel each other out. And so we left off at the end of class talking about the relationship of these intermolecular forces and their physical properties. But where we need to pick up today then is, well, what about things that aren't permanent molecular forces? So I want to start out talking about temporary dipoles. So these are dipoles not caused by molecular structure. And therefore, are not permanent in nature. Not nature capital N, like in nature out there in the planet. I mean, like it's not what they are. They come about for one of two reasons. And so these subtypes, these are labels I put on them. We're going to, at some point, put more official labels, because you might have heard terms like van der Waals forces or dispersion forces, London dispersion forces, hydrogen bonding, dipole-dipole, dipole-ion, this, though, that. So what are all these different types of attractions? I know there's different labels, and I know I haven't gotten to them, but that's why I'm building up one at a time. So we did permanent molecular dipoles the other day, which, if you're reading the text or other sources, that would be what would be called dipole-dipole interaction, one molecule interacting with another. Temporary dipoles, there's two reasons that come about, and one of them I call spontaneous dipoles. And a great example of this is the molecule iodine. Iodine is a solid at room temperature at normal atmospheric pressure. It's a pretty kind of purplish crystal. Oh, sorry, someone was asking a question. And I just realized, if anyone's raising your hand, I had the chat window blocked, so sorry about that. How does temperature change the intermolecular forces to change things into a liquid or solid? Let me go back and review that again later, because I'm kind of on a flow here with iodine at the moment. I'll loop back and do that after I plug my power adapter in so we don't lose this whole darn lecture. Wow. Well, let me talk a little bit, because on the screen at least you can see that it says iodine is a solid at room temperature. Interestingly enough, iodine also has a large vapor pressure. So we have to get to the six phase changes of matter: melting, freezing, boiling, condensing, and then the two that everybody has to learn, which are deposition and sublimation. Iodine readily goes from its solid phase into a vapor phase, and that process is called sublimation. But why is it a solid at room temperature? Because, and I've almost got this thing plugged in, what kind of bond does iodine have? Like, what would the Lewis dot structure for iodine be? Rather simple, actually, it turns out. It's just the two iodines connected to each other. And neither iodine has a formal charge. So, what kind of shape does this molecule have? Linear, of course. If it's linear and the two atoms are equivalent, that means they're equivalent in electronegativity. So what can we say about the bond and therefore the whole molecule? Nonpolar. And tying it into Wednesday's lecture, that means it has no permanent molecular dipole. Now let me loop back, actually, because someone asked the question, what's the relationship between temperature and changing liquids into solids and gases or whatever? So let me, I didn't want to do that. Hold on. I wanted to do this. So the point is this. If you have, if you look at the graph that's at the top of the page being displayed now, and for those of you who are listening to this later on, this is in page 4 of Wednesday, April 22nd's notes. It's a graph that shows the molecular energy distribution at a particular temperature and shows two different heats of vaporization. So the arguments I make here are this. That when you have a molecule that has a strong molecular dipole, that means that it has a higher heat of vaporization. And if you have a higher heat of vaporization, it therefore takes more energy to either melt it or boil it, so it's going to have a higher melting or boiling point. Iodine doesn't have a permanent molecular dipole. And so based on that, you should think it should have low intermolecular forces, which means it should have what's more like the purple in the graph of this previous sets of notes, similar to methane. It should have a low heat of vaporization, and so it should be a gas at room temperature. But it's not. So back to today's notes. If iodine has no permanent molecular dipole, that means in theory it shouldn't be able to exist.
I think it's frozen, or you didn't switch B.
It looks like it is option 1. Shouldn't be able to be a solid. At room temperature. But it is. So, for those of you who have been my student before, you know there's a question in these situations that I'm very likely to ask you. And just so I do not disappoint them, those former students, how many of you have read the book? And can therefore tell me what the answer is. Ooh, a whole 2 people in the class. 3! Wow! What chapter is this in? What chapter is this in? That's a good question. I don't have the textbook in front of me here. One moment. Oh, of course, chapter 12. Which you know, there's this thing called a syllabus. You know that thing that the instructor writes up at the beginning of the quarter, tells you due dates and deadlines and topics and things? The, you know, the one? Oh, yeah, that one. Wow. Okay, back to the notes, just so we don't get lost here. I was asking if anybody can tell me, why is iodine able to be a solid if it doesn't have these permanent molecular forces? London dispersion forces, or to put it in another way, it's got temporary dipoles. So iodine's a big atom, which means if you looked at the electron density around iodine, there's a lot of it. Now, that electron density is not as tightly held as in something like fluorine. Fluorine is a very compact ion, has very high charge density. If it helps think of it this way. If you have F minus versus I minus, they're both the same charge, but hugely different in size. So fluorine would have high charge density. While iodine would have low charge density. So now, even if we're talking about neutral iodine, you still have the same situation, same overall charge density. So that means if iodine doesn't hold on to its charge density very tightly, it kind of wobbles around a bit. So in other words, at any one moment, there may be these partial positives and negatives that develop by, if you want to, okay, here's the technical, and I'll translate it in English. Spontaneous polarizability. So spontaneous polarizability is the ability of an atom or molecule to develop temporary dipoles. Oops. Due to the movement of the molecule I should say atom molecule and low charge density. So I should find a video of this. And I won't waste the time to do it right this second. But hopefully I can find a nice example of this molecule just wiggling around in space. You know, the iodine-iodine bond is going to expand, contract, or go back and forth like this. And so while that's happening, what if there's some asymmetry that just happens to develop? Then that's what, yes, this term is usually called London dispersion forces. But like I said, I wanted to tell the full story of what's going on first, and then I'll start putting labels on everything. This is a spontaneous dipole. Molecule not doing anything, like not even interacting with anything else, just its own self changing shape and having that electron density wiggle around. So if everybody could take your screenshots, please, so I can get this first page and then move on. So, the phrase that you're probably going to just blindly copy into the quiz or test. Because iodine has very low charge density. And a large size. It easily develops enough temporary dipoles that the overall intermolecular forces are strong enough to hold iodine together as a solid. At the standard state. See, we were talking about STP conditions before, and I didn't want to bring up the standard state to not confuse people more. But STP is something in gas land. Standard state is thermodynamics. 1 bar pressure, 25 degrees Celsius. So just in case you don't know that, standard state, 1 bar pressure. I can't write. 25 degrees Celsius. Because iodine has a very low charge density and a large size, it easily develops enough temporary dipoles that the overall intermolecular forces are strong enough to hold iodine together as a solid at the standard state, despite the fact it has no permanent molecular dipole. Now, no, for the quiz, I wasn't talking about the standard state. That's why I said before that I didn't mention the standard state before. But now that the quiz is already supposed to be done, that's why I can say it now. Standard state, something different. Okay, this is not the only situation where this happens in. Now, the other day I showed you the structure of oleic acid. If you don't quite remember how to interpret this structure, every one of the places on this curve, or this drawing, where you don't see any labels, that represents carbon. So, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. All those represent carbon. And as a reminder, if you look how many bonds are there, carbon's supposed to have 4 bonds to it. If it doesn't, you assume it has enough hydrogens to make up the difference. So all around this is a whole mess of hydrogen. Which, let's say I choose not to draw them all in because it just takes so long. But I'll just say here that that color represents hydrogen. Whoa. What did I do to my poor carbon? Must be that donut or something, because I'm thinking carbo instead of carbon. Okay, so what's the point of this? One portion of this molecule is very polar. But if you were able to read that structure properly, that's a total of 4 atoms that make up this functional group, this carboxylic acid. But if you count up the rest of the structure, there are 17 carbons, There's at least 30-something hydrogens. Oh, come on, I can do this really quickly. Let's see. If you have 17 carbons, that's supposed to be 36, but we have a double bond, so that's 34. And then we have this connection we've made, so that's 33. And that's hydrogens added to the 17. So that's 50 atoms if I can do my math in my head fast enough. And it's very nonpolar. Why? Because you have most of the structure nonpolar. And only this tiny little polar bit to it. And it's not polar enough to make the whole molecule polar. So oleic acid is nonpolar because although a small portion of the molecule is polar, the vast majority of the structure is nonpolar. But again, it's a huge molecule, so there's so much surface area now that it has the ability develop these temporary positive and negative molecules. So it's the, not molecules, charges. So it's the same story I was telling before, just a different example. And the reason I'm telling you this is because this is what facts are related to. If you take three of these molecules, three molecules like this, long carbon chain ending in a carboxylic acid, that is called a fatty acid. If you combine fatty acids in a reaction with a simple molecule called glycerol, you get what's called a triglyceride, which is a fat molecule. Why are fat molecules solids if they're nonpolar? Because they're huge molecules. And so they have exactly the same type of formation of temporary dipoles that causes iodine to come together. When I say iodine is big, it's big in comparison to diatomic molecules. In fact, I should add that here. Where did I say that? Iodine is, and it is large in size. So I'm going to add a note here where I can squeeze it in. Which this is annoying to all of you writing on paper. But because I've joined the digital age, I'm just waiting for that Borg implant. But I'm waiting for version 1.01. See, I can move my notes so I can make myself that space compared to other diatomic molecules. There we go. So down here, oleic acid is just flat big. So, however, due to oleic acid's large size, and therefore large surface area, it experiences enough temporary dipoles that it has enough intermolecular forces that it turns solid slightly below room temperature. I don't remember the exact temperature. I just know if you put a bottle of it in the refrigerator, it'll freeze. So that's one example of intermolecular forces, or temporary intermolecular forces. Any questions before we move on to the next page? There is one last example of temporary intermolecular forces I need to talk about before I put all this together systematically. Because it is possible to have molecules that have ions. And I know this is going to confuse or frustrate people because you like to think there's covalent substances and ionic substances. Well, a substance can be both. If you take that same oleic acid, take the hydrogen off, put a sodium on, you now get a molecule that's got a very polar end at one end, but a very nonpolar end at the other end. And so you get this very split behavior. But that means that it's a covalent molecule. It's got all these 50-something atoms, but it's got an ion at the end as well. So the distinction of covalent and ionic compound gets a little messy once molecules get big. Okay, so the point is, you can have ions involved in this whole discussion as well. So let's say that we have a sodium ion. And let's say that you have molecular iodine, so not I minus, molecular iodine, which remember I said is going to have this cloud of electrons around it. Now, even though these two things are not going to bond, and they're not going to even necessarily react, they can interact. And because of that plus charge being there, if it gets close to the iodine, it's going to want to draw iodine to the surface, because that's closer to the positive charge. Of course, if it's pulling charge one direction, then somewhere else, positive charge is going to develop as a result. Now, as soon as the sodium moves on, these attractions are gone as well. So again, that's why this is temporary. And this type of dipole is what is known as an induced dipole. When a particle with a charge or a dipole passes another particle, that charge or dipole on the first molecule can cause a partial charge to develop on the second molecule. This is known as induction. And induction comes up in a lot of discussions of chemical structures. So, induced dipoles are another form of temporary dipole. So let's go ahead and put all these different types of dipole and whatever types of interactions together. So there's this term, van der Waals forces. And those are any attractions between any particles, electrostatic attractions between particles. So the stronger of these forces are any time that ions get involved with other ions. But let's say we're sticking to talking about molecules. A molecule could have a permanent molecular dipole. So the strongest of these van der Waals forces would be ion-dipole interactions. And so by dipole, that does mean permanent. You could also have what would be called dipole-dipole interactions. And these would also be called permanent interactions. This family of forces is technically known as Keesom forces, which is not in your text. And yes, I got it from Wikipedia. But you know, Wikipedia and science tends to be correct because there's an awful lot of geeks out there that want to be right. So just think on that for a moment. And that's why a lot of stuff in Wikipedia and science tends to be more correct than not. So I'm just guessing that is true. Now, these are for permanent molecular dipoles. What if you have induced dipoles? Generally, induced dipoles are weaker than permanent ones. Because permanent ones, they're always there because of molecular structure. These temporary ones, as soon as molecules move around, then they change. But of course, I just gave you two contrasting examples. Iodine and this oleic acid, a fatty acid, that they have large enough temporary dipoles that it causes them to be a solid. So this is a general statement that an ion-dipole interaction that is temporary and that could be, again, an induced dipole. Well, it would be an induced dipole in this case. Or, let's say you have two induced dipoles. Or let's just keep it simple. Let's say dipole with a temporary dipole. These are what are technically known as Debye forces. The last one is the instantaneous dipole. The word I used earlier may be spontaneous. And that is what is known as London dispersion forces. So your text talks about all of these. Ion Debye. I wrote my B badly. One moment. There we go. Okay, so I was saying all these terms, ion dipole, dion dipole, instantaneous, those are in the text. Van der Waals is a general term for all of them. Keesom you won't see, Debye you won't see, but London dispersion forces you'll see. And so these London dispersion forces are the spontaneous dipole forces. Now someone asks, is there a threshold in size in which London dispersion forces appear? No, because it's the only thing holding helium together. Of course you have to get helium down to pretty close to absolute zero. But I can make this statement because it's true. All substances experience London dispersion forces. Oh my gosh. So he denied that it was Dubai. Wow. You know, that's going to cause me to release my one and only funny chemistry joke on the people that hadn't heard it before. So two Adams were walking down the road one day, and one Adam turns to the other and says, "You know, I think I just lost an electron." And the second Adam says, "Are you sure?" And the first Adam says, "Yeah, I'm positive." Ha ha ha. I know. I told you. It's the one funny chemistry joke. I just told it to get a reaction out of you. Ah! Of course, it might lead to a charged conversation. Oh! Sorry, I just had to get that out of my system. Okay, so what's the point of all this? That's the point. That's your set of intermolecular forces. Now, with the little itty-bitty time I got left, I wanted to introduce the topic I think we were supposed to do today, which was phase diagrams. Oh my gosh. So yeah, by the way, when I insisted there were no other funny chemistry jokes, I got totally schooled because a student in my class found some. I just don't have them handy because I forgot about them until right now. And then he told me about a book that's like all science jokes, and they're good ones. So maybe I'll bust that out one of these times. Oh gosh, yeah, I knew that was going to happen. So just because I've got low on time, I got to ignore the other jokes you all are picking up off the internet here to talk about phase diagrams. Once we know what kinds of intermolecular forces a substance has, there is a general way that substances behave. Now, on this diagram, it's traditional that pressures put on the y-axis, temperatures put on the x-axis. So just think about it for a moment. What phase of matter do you think you would have if you had really, really high temperature and low pressure? Gas. That's right. So this is the gas phase that's over here on the right. And reverse, what if you had really high pressure, low temperature? That's right, a solid. And then in the in-between phase here is a liquid. But notice that a liquid is an in-between phase, because there is a portion of this diagram where you can see that substances transit directly from solid to gas. And that a good example of that is dry ice, solid carbon dioxide. So if you never knew what dry ice was before, that's carbon dioxide that's been frozen. Because of carbon dioxide's small nonpolar structure, at atmospheric pressure, when there's enough energy for it to wiggle apart, it doesn't stay a liquid, it just wiggles apart. It goes straight to the gas phase. Once you get carbon dioxide under enough pressure, then you can get it to turn into liquid. In fact, if you put it up into enough pressure, you then get what's called a supercritical fluid, which some of you might have heard of that before. We will get to all that soon because I'm about to run out of time. So those of you who need your screenshots of this third page, please get them because I'm going to rush through to the end of this just to give us some context for Monday. So on this diagram, each of the lines represents equilibrium. The lines or curves on the diagram represent pressure-temperature combinations in which phases of matter are in equilibrium. Yes, pressure is representative of the pressure and acting on the surface, not pressure created by itself. Yes, you could say the external pressure that the system is under. And in the case of a balloon, for example, the external pressure that holds the balloon at the size that then creates the same pressure inside. So actually any of these curves, and just to make it clear, let me do this. Notice there's a place where all the curves meet. So that's the green, and that is what is known as the triple point. So the triple point represents the temperature and pressure at which all three phases of matter are in equilibrium. And I'll send out a link once I find it again. A student actually sent me this. It was a pretty neat looking video of the triple point of water. And you could see ice forming at the same time that water was boiling, because both of those processes were equal energy. So you had liquid and you had vapor and you had solid, and they were all transitioning back and forth to each other because they were all at equilibrium. That's what the triple point of a substance is. Now, just let me label it and I'll give a short description because I know we're running late and you might have other classes. There's a place where the phase boundary breaks down. And that is something known as the critical point. And so let me define it, give a short definition. I mean, write it, short definition, short explanation, and we'll wrap up for today. So if anyone has any last questions, please go ahead and throw them to the chat window while I'm writing this out. The critical point is where the distinction between a gas and liquid disappears. This fluid, called a supercritical fluid, has the density of a liquid, because it's under so much pressure, but the molecular mobility due to the high temperature of a gas. Remember, we did these macroscopic and microscopic pictures a few days ago, what the phases of matter look like. And for a liquid, you have molecules that are clinging together. And for gas, they're all just spread out. So this is still acting like a gas, where the particles are technically, they're not condensed due to attractions. They're just so compressed by the pressure that it is dense like a liquid, but flows like a gas. And so that point where the distinction breaks down is known as the critical point. What point is plasma? That's a way higher temperature even. And that's where you start ripping electrons off of everything because of how high temperature you are. So that's a fourth phase of matter, not normally shown on these types of diagrams, because the pressures or temperatures you need plasma are way off the scales of most ordinary substances that are mapped at more ordinary conditions.